fourth case of the day, the United States v. Rogers. Ms. Winslow?
Good morning, Your Honor. Good morning, Counsel. This morning, Stephen Rogers is serving a 25-year sentence in prison for communicating with an individual online who he never met. We never discussed any personal private information because he misrepresented, in fact, his identity. And nonetheless, following a trial in which the jury was improperly instructed, in which counts were improperly joined, and which the jury found an obscenity count for which there is simply no evidence to sustain, Mr. Rogers was convicted. We ask, Your Honors, to reverse count two, that's the obscenity count, and to remand for a new trial as to counts three and four. I'll begin with the obscenity counts unless Your Honors have particular questions about the other issues that are raised. The government and I are in a disagreement as to this court's standard of review as to the obscenity count. Obviously, it's at its heart an insufficiency of the evidence claim, but the real meat behind the claim, if you will, is a First Amendment violation. The photograph in question here is a photograph of Mr. Rogers' genitalia. It's nothing more. It's not particularly suggestive in any unusual way.
Well, it does show the penis as erect, doesn't it?
It does.
And in his hand.
It does, but I think the characterization of it as him masturbating would be incorrect.
I thought Judge Cannelli said that, having seen the picture, the jurors could conclude that that's what was happening.
I think that would be an incorrect finding.
You're saying that that's a clearly erroneous determination by Judge Cannelli?
I am, Your Honor, but I have to step back a bit and address the court's standard of review. Because this is a First Amendment claim, it is incumbent upon this court to look at the photograph and to make its own determination. Because we're touching on a First Amendment constitutional right here, it goes beyond simply the clearly erroneous findings of fact that we normally would have in a credibility finding by the district court. Based on the content of the photograph at issue in this case, we believe that simply looking at this picture, you cannot find that it is obscene. It's in the days following this trial, there were no less than three news stories about sports stars, celebrities, other individuals.
Congressmen
who text messaged, tweeted, or some other ill-advised move, sent similar pictures to individuals who they knew or didn't know. The fact is that there's nothing obscene about this picture. It's the same type of picture that could be found on any number of Internet sites, but even if Your Honors don't wish to reach the Internet as the community in question for the obscenity standard, any number of newsstands. Any number, we could probably walk down to 7-Eleven down the street on Dearborn and find something similar to it. Fact is, it's just simply not obscene.
So your position would be that the erect state and the touching depicted in the photo would still not make it obscene?
That's correct.
Under community, prevailing community standard?
Under the Miller standard.
Didn't have a tagline with it? Had a comment with it, didn't it?
I hope you like it or something along those lines, yes.
Should that be factored in?
I don't think so. I mean, that would be a fairly standard tagline, if you wish to call it that, for that type of photograph. I trust that some of the other pictures we were just talking about came with similar commentary.
Okay.
Unless there's further questions on the obscenity issue, I'll move on. The question of severance. The government has alleged that the severance issue wasn't properly preserved, that, in fact, it wasn't properly renewed. And I couldn't disagree more. The fact is, the severance issue was the subject of extensive litigation before Judge Shader, which followed a recusal from Judge Shader of what would have been the first trial, which followed from that the first appeal in this case, which Your Honor is familiar with, following then Judge Cannelli, when the case was reassigned to Judge Cannelli, gave us the opportunity to brief the issue again. Given the opportunity to brief the issue, multiple times in multiple proceedings before Judge Cannelli until he finally issued a lengthy written opinion. It was further the subject of post-trial motions. The United States versus Brown and none of this court's jurisdiction.
But isn't it required that you raise it at the close of evidence when all the information has been played out in front of the jury and the judge can make that critical determination?
It would be in the instance which it was not so clearly a continuing objection. United States versus Brown indicates that, in my words, not the court's, you're not required to beat your head against the wall in order to remind the court that there is an objection. This was a primary theme throughout this trial, just as most mid-trial and post-trial objections are taken under advisement during the trial. This was clearly a continuing objection throughout the trial. The fact is, it was a complaint of Mr. Rogers from the very well, not from the very beginning, from the ultimate superseding indictment that resulted in the four counts that we went to trial on. As to the merits of the severance issue, I think Judge Kennelly illustrated it best himself during the sentencing hearing and the page number cited in the brief. When Judge Kennelly was imposing sentence as to counts 3 and 4, and those are the counts to do with the person we refer to as Andrea, he referred almost solely to the chats relating to the individual we refer to as Emily. Of course, Emily was an agent. Emily didn't exist. And more to the point that's relevant to this court, the conduct with respect to Emily was acquitted. Mr. Rogers was not convicted of any of the chats, the picture, but not of the chats or the solicitation that was charged as to the individual known as Emily. In his remarks at sentencing, Judge Kennelly acknowledged that there was very little in terms of corroborating evidence as to what supposedly was said between Mr. Rogers and Andrea, but he looked back to the chats between Emily and Mr. Rogers. Obviously, once again, acquitted conduct. But in those chats, well, it's acquitted conduct, but it's our position that it was largely induced by the government's chats to Mr. Rogers. Nonetheless, there is discussion of having the fictional Emily send Mr. Rogers specific types of photographs, specifically photographs of her genitalia, naked pictures, that type of photograph. Now, there aren't corresponding corroborative facts or any evidence as to Andrea. The evidence as to Andrea was actually relatively weak. We have Andrea herself testifying. We have the fact of a photograph that was found in the trash of Mr. Rogers' computer. It wasn't saved, just to be clear. And we have a very limited universe of chat between the two individuals. There's no discussion about going offline, about changing media formats, in other words, to going to a chat format. All you have is a limited number of emails in which Andrea herself says that she likes to smoke and hang out with her friends. She refers to a boyfriend that she has. But in these chat or in these emails, she gives no indication of her age, and he does ask her for a picture, but makes no clarifications as to the type of picture he's looking for.
But she did testify that she gave her age on several occasions, through texting, something that was not preserved.
It was an instant messaging format that she testified to, and I'll address that briefly. I realize that it goes to
there was some evidence that she gave her age.
There was some evidence, Your Honor, but the fact is that evidence was minimal compared to the evidence of the chats between Mr. Rogers and Emily. The reason I say that, in addition, is that when Andrea was first interviewed by the FBI in relation to this case, she claimed no memory of Mr. Rogers. Well, she continued to claim no memory of Mr. Rogers, but no memory of those conversations. She claimed no recollection whatsoever as to why she took those pictures or how she described himself or herself to Mr. Rogers in the chats. It wasn't until multiple interviews later that she then suddenly remembered that, yes, very specifically, she told him she was 14 years old, she told him all of these other salient facts, and that he specifically requested the pictures that she ultimately sent. Given the weakness, the questionable nature of that evidence, it's not inconceivable. In fact, it's overwhelmingly likely that the jury would have looked to the evidence as to Emily.
Now, it's weak. Why, Ms. Wilson?
Winslow, I'm sorry. That's okay. I didn't mean to correct, Your Honor. It's weak because it's contradicted by her original statements. She didn't, in fact,
Did that come out in cross?
It did. But even Judge Kennelly acknowledged in his comments at sentencing that it was relatively weak. When he looked to, in fact, the evidence to the chats, the specific nature of the conversations between Emily and Mr. Rogers in order to support the conviction for Mr. Rogers to the Andrea conduct, if you will, then it's clear that even Judge Canale was overlapping and intertwining the evidence. Improper, certainly. But if a federal district court judge, who not only knows the instructions, he probably knows them better than, well, certainly myself, if he's to do that, it certainly is a reasonable assumption that the jury would do that. The trial in this case is approximately a week, a little over a week, including breaks. All but half of one day concerned the conversations between Mr. Rogers and Emily, the acquitted conduct. There was essentially two witnesses that had anything to do with Andrea. Andrea herself and one other law enforcement witness. Given the overwhelming...
Now, you say acquitted. You're not suggesting that the jurors concluded those conversations didn't occur.
I'm not suggesting...
It seems to me they just determined that it wasn't the grooming or the conduct that the statute prohibited.
They did conclude... I don't know what they concluded, Judge. I honestly didn't speak to them afterwards. But they did not convict him of solicitation.
They convicted of the photograph part of it, which was referred to during those conversations.
That's true. They did. I mean, I don't think there was a lot of dispute that the conversations occurred. The dispute in the trial was whether or not Mr. Rogers ever had any intent to solicit this individual. And because there were multiple occasions on which the agent acting as Emily tried to encourage Mr. Rogers to meet him, and on none of those occasions did he take the bait, if you will, it was our position that there was no solicitation. It was just chat. It was just conversation online. And as to the conversations online, it's the government's position that... Because Andrea told Mr. Rogers an age and sent a picture, that those were in fact indicative to Mr. Rogers that she was 14 and that was her picture. Belied, of course, by the fact that Mr. Rogers represented himself as much younger and sent a fake picture. The same fake picture, I'll add, to both Andrea and Emily, which represented himself as entirely different appearing than in fact he does in real life. It wouldn't be the first time someone has sent a picture over the Internet that doesn't accurately reflect their appearance, I would submit. Perhaps the court could take judicial notice of that. I see I'm running out of time, but I would just very briefly touch on the knowledge requirements as to counts 3 and 4. Once again, I think it's disingenuous for the government to argue that the challenges were not preserved. We, of course, did have what I've come to see as an unfortunate procedure, which is to have the bulk of our jury instruction conversation take place in chambers. I'm not, at this juncture, prepared to say why that happened in that way. Some of the objections could have been better preserved, but it's clear from the record that you do have that the defense raised an objection as to the lack of knowledge requirement. Very briefly, obviously, we're well aware of United States versus Fletcher. In my brief, I acknowledge that. I ask Your Honors to reverse that case. But as to count 3, the government does concede error, although it argues that it's either not clear or that it's harmless. Under either standard, the government's argument must fail because what it in essence relies upon is its own analysis, its own view of the evidence, which is in particular the photograph of Andrea. I'd encourage Your Honors to look at the photograph. Obviously, it's part of the record. And looking at that photograph, you can see that it's relatively blurry and that it is very difficult to tell the age of that individual. I don't think the government's in any better position than we are to do so.
Thank you, Ms. Winslow. Ms. Fillet?
May it please the court, counsel. Shelby Fillet for the United States. With respect to the obscenity count, the heart of the matter is sufficiency. The question is, did the district court correctly allow the jury to decide whether the image was obscene? It did, and it properly denied the defendant's Rule 29 motion. Viewing the evidence in light most favorable to the government, there was ample evidence upon which a rational jury could have found the defendant guilty of attempting to transfer obscene material to a minor. Turning to the defendant's argument that this is really a First Amendment question and therefore relies on a different standard, looking at the William White decision from this court, the question of whether or not there is a First Amendment violation can in fact turn on whether or not, on the jury, It's a question of fact for the jury, which was true in this particular case. The jury was properly instructed of the Miller test. They applied that test, and the jury came to the conclusion that this particular image was obscene.
Well, I've got to say, I'm pretty troubled by this issue. If this were a video and there were activity, the obscenity would have seemed pretty evident. As a still photograph here, how would the jurors know that this masturbation was what was being depicted in the photo?
That is for the jury to decide, Your Honor. That's exactly what the point of the Miller test requires. They go through their own analysis. They decide, as from their perspective, as an average person applying contemporary community standards, would they find that the work appeals to the prurient interest?
So if the hand were not depicted on the penis, would this have been obscene? Your next case?
That I think it still depends on what the jury sees when they look at the evidence. And in this case, the jury looked at this picture.
So what about that congressman's photo where it's just a depiction of him in the buff?
If the jury was presented with that photo and applying the Miller standard...
You would charge that photo if that got to a 14-year-old?
I can't say whether or not we would charge it. It would very much probably depend, but it certainly could be.
Could you under this standard?
Absolutely. And it would be up to the jury to make the decision whether or not, from their perspective, this image was obscene. And that's what this jury did.
That's very troubling. It's hard to know when one violates that statute.
I think, though, the ultimate point of the Miller test, though, is it really looks at, from the average community standards, it's really looking at what do people think of when they look at this image. And the fact that these images are available around the world, around the country, maybe at the corner newsstand, as defense counsel noted, is not really relevant, because the fact that it's available doesn't necessarily make it acceptable. And the question really is, what did this jury think when it looked at the image and applied the Miller standard as it properly did?
So does it matter that it was something sent to 14-year-old as opposed to a consenting adult?
It does for purposes of the statute, but not for purposes of ascertaining whether or not the image was obscene.
Well, you rely in part on the contemporaneous chats, too, right, to provide the context for this?
Certainly. Certainly, Your Honor. And that was the evidence that was presented at trial, and the jury was certainly provided the evidence, and taking that evidence and that context, along with the tagline, "I hope you like it," which they're certainly at their leisure to do, and applying the Miller standard, the jury found that this image was obscene in convicting the defendant on this count. Turning to the severance issue, the government submits that the defendant's failure to renew this motion to sever at the close of evidence at trial was a waiver. But in any event, the district court's dismissal was not an abuse of discretion. The defendant asserts that at sentencing, the judge referred solely to the chats with Emily. But all of the evidence was properly admitted at trial. The district court specifically ruled prior to trial, in motions in limine and with respect to the severance motion, that the evidence supporting counts 3 and 4 would be admitted at a trial of just the counts 1 and 2, and vice versa. So the fact that the evidence was admissible shows that it's irrelevant of whether or not the jury was relying on one versus the other. They would have heard all of that evidence, even if the counts had been severed. Furthermore, any disparity in the weight of evidence did not actually prejudice the defendant. In fact, the jury acquitted the defendant on count 1, showing that they can compartmentalize the evidence on each count. And the court actually properly instructed the jury to consider each count separately and supporting evidence accordingly. The jury followed those instructions. Furthermore, Andrea's testimony was absolutely credible. The fact that she, when first interviewed by agents, she was young, she was 14 when she had these conversations with this defendant. The fact that she, and as argued at trial, the fact that she may have been scared or didn't want to admit to it the first time she's interviewed by federal agents is not surprising. But she did ultimately admit, yes, she had these conversations. Yes, she told the defendant on three different occasions. She's 14 years old. She sent the defendant two pictures of herself, both of her face, showing that she's a young girl. She sent him two pictures of her naked body, one of her genitalia and one of her breasts, also showing that she's a young girl. The theory that because the defendant goes online and misrepresents himself doesn't automatically assume that the Andrea did the same thing. That said, the fact that the jury may have considered all of that other evidence from counts from the 2005 conduct, which supported counts 1 and 2, again, that evidence was properly admitted. So it also corroborates Andrea. It shows that the defendant continued to talk to young girls, even when he knew they were young, and that he had interest in sex with young girls, despite knowing that it was illegal. In fact, through those chats, there were specific conversations in which he stated, we could get in trouble against the law.
How old was she when she testified, 18?
Yes, Your Honor, approximately. Turning to the jury instructions, with respect to count three, there's nothing in the record to show that the defendant ever preserved an objection with respect to the knowledge element in count three. Therefore, and by not raising that objection and giving ample opportunity on the record to preserve objections, the defendant waived the right to raise this on appeal. Nevertheless, the defendant did not, the failure to include this instruction did not affect the defendant's substantial rights because there was a substantial evidence that the defendant knew the depicted, the person depicted in the image was a minor. As discussed before, we have the pictures of her face. We have the other pictures of her. We have the fact that she told him a number of times that she was 14 years old. In fact, and furthermore, the government didn't actually argue otherwise. They didn't argue that knowledge was of the victim's age was not required. And on rebuttal, in response to a defense argument in closing that there was no evidence to this effect, the government asserted that Andrea told the defendant numerous times what her age was, and the government talked about the picture showing how old she could be, or how old she was. And even if this objection was properly preserved, which of course the government submits it was not, the error was harmless because it's clear beyond a reasonable doubt that a rational jury would have found that the defendant was guilty based on the evidence if properly instructed. And the error was harmless because the government presented the relevant evidence at trial. Turning to count four, the defendant concedes that the defendant's knowledge of the victim's age is not an element of the statute, but instead asks the court to overrule Fletcher. The defendant's misconstruing the analysis under excitement video, and it overruling Fletcher, it would create a circuit split. Fletcher is an accurate statement of the law and is consistent with all the other circuits that consider this issue and that looked at excitement video. There's really no reason now to create a split where none exists. There are no further questions.
I want to take you back to 1417. I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but is it your position then that a mere nude depiction of genitalia would fit obscenity under that statute?
If the jury made that determination applying the Miller standard.
The Miller standard recognizes that not all nudity or not all things that are pornographic necessarily are obscene.
Absolutely, and in this case, the jury specifically found that this image was obscene.
So your position would be then that any nude depiction of genitalia could be prosecuted under 14.7.
I think that's a different question of whether or not, in this case, the jury finding that this picture was obscene.
It does go beyond this case, but I'm concerned about that next case. I'm concerned about the 15-year-old who texts a photograph of her genitalia to her friend, who's also under 16.
And certainly the prosecutorial discretion would advise, but in this particular case, the jury looked at this picture and the associated context and specifically found under Miller that the image was obscene.
Because the genitalia was involved in a sex act, does that make a difference?
Why the jury made this conclusion, I cannot say.
But doesn't it have to meet some certain level before, so that it goes beyond mere nudity to something that would be obscene?
I think that goes back to what the prosecutorial discretion, whether or not the government would charge an image. And I can't answer that because this case, in this record, is really specific to what did the jury decide based on the Miller standard.
But a person subject to the statute has to know more than just that the prosecutor has discretion. They have to know whether the conduct's going to violate the statute.
Certainly. Frankly, that's the best answer I have, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. And the government will respectfully request that the defendant's conviction be affirmed. Thank you.
Ms. Winslow.
Beginning with Your Honor's questions as to the obscenity statutes, first of all, I would refer the court to Brockett versus Spokane Arcades for the discussion of whether anatomy, in that case it was female anatomy, posed in any position, as they said in Brockett, could in fact be obscene. Of course, the Supreme Court said in Brockett that it cannot be. And it's our position, looking at the picture, that it is simply a pose rather than an act that's taking place. Again, we believe it's this court's obligation to review the photograph under the First Amendment standard so that we are protecting the First Amendment right to freedom of expression.
Can we look at the photo apart from the contemporaneous chats? For purposes of assessing whether the jury found that obscene, Ms. Winslow?
I believe you must look at it separately from the contemporaneous chats. The transmission of the photograph to the individual alleging herself to be Emily, that's what the chats are relevant to nothing more. The standard for obscenity under the statute is the same as it would be for any transmission to any other individual, which is why the fact that this same type of photograph, similar photographs, could be found at the corner newsstand, at 7-Eleven, or what have you, is in fact relevant to the consideration.
I'm not sure that these kind of photos can be.
I haven't done my own personal survey, but I think, Judge, it's simply a photograph of a penis, to put it out there. I mean, it really is.
You're suggesting it's the equivalent of a medical text.
I think the context in this particular, I wouldn't.
Well, that's why I was speaking about the chats, Ms. Winslow.
I don't think the chats are relevant, however, to the context. I mean, the fact that it's simply taken on a cell phone and transmitted to another individual is the context that I'm referring to.
Should we consider that it was transmitted to a 14-year-old as opposed to a 20-year-old?
You cannot. You cannot, Judge. The standard is the same. The statute does not set out an alternate standard for obscenity. If this court were to find there's an alternate standard for obscenity, it would obviously violate his due process rights, Mr. Rogers' due process rights. We would ask that his conviction on his count two be reversed, remanded for dismissal, and that the remainder of the counts be reversed for a new trial. Thank you.
All right, thanks to all counsel. Ms. Winslow, you have the additional thanks of the court for accepting this appointment.
Thank you, Your Honor.